podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the 500th FYP podcast. That's right, and you'll have probably seen already on the title of the pod, we've got a very special guest, the one and only Roy Hodgson is joining us today on the podcast, current Palace manager. We've just recorded with him, we're going to get into it very quickly. Before I do that, let's introduce, Steve Browett's here. Steve, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for hosting us again.
Always a pleasure to have you here. We've had a few Palace people over the years.
We have. You've been a big part of the pod down the years with our interviews that we've had here.
Yeah, I mean, I used to listen to FYP pods, you know, when I was a humble junior fan before we bought the club in 2010, and have carried on, obviously.
We really appreciate it. Kevin's here. Kevin, how are you? Happy 500.
Thank you very much. Happy 500th to you. It seems like only yesterday when I was in that hostage situation in your... Yeah, in your flat with Andy Street. And the only thing this is missing here, this brings back such happy memories being around Steve's dining table. The only thing we're missing is James Endicott face down in a cake of some sort.
He was very drunk. Was that with
him?
Jedinak.
That was the
2016 Cup final.
Yeah.
We do miss Enders.
Although, to be fair, Steve, that was partly your fault. Because you provided a different vintage of wine for every year that we've been in the playoffs.
Yes, I had a little theme, a little wine theme.
We'd been in the playoffs quite often. So we started off, as I recall, drinking it properly, your instructions, and by the end of it, we were necking it out of a teapot.
This is a very different episode, this one, with Roy here. Rob Sutherland's also here. Rob, how are you doing?
Hello, good, thank you. I'm pleased to have been a spectator for this interview, but also just to have been part of the FYP gang and to have witnessed the quality that you and Andy and James and Kevin and everyone that's been involved has put out on a weekly basis. And I think as a fan myself of the podcast and someone who listens to the weekly one, it is just such a massive thing that you have done, JD, and that Andy did, and that Kevin and James as well. You both have created this kind of, you've all created this foundation that Palace fans can hold on to and listen to, and some stability in life. You know, there's a lot of things that happen in everyone's daily lives, but knowing that the podcast is going to be there on a Tuesday or Wednesday is a significant thing, and I think you really deserve a huge amount of credit.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Also, a big shout out for our original sponsors, without whom we wouldn't be here. So, for all your embroidery needs, and Mr. JC, I will.
We should say that this interview series, which is a part of, is sponsored by our friends at Eternity Home Finance this season. They're a Croydon-based Palace-supporting, family-run mortgage and protection advisors. From getting on the property ladder to planning your retirement, email info@eternityhomefinance.com. And for a free consultation, quote the code FYP. Steve, we've just recorded with Roy, who gave us over an hour of his time, which is fantastic. What a guy.
Isn't he great? He's, he's such an intelligent man, but humble at the same time. You know, with his huge experience and obvious intelligence, he could be arrogant, but he's not in any way at all. He's a really good man. He's always got time for people. If you introduce someone to him, he remembers their name and is charming. Obviously his football pedigree is incredible. And he's a Palace fan, so born and bred in Croydon.
He said some very nice things about the podcast at the end of the episode. He's presented us with a fantastic Palace shirt with FYP 500. And Kevin, really, this is a bit of a coup, isn't it, for us, for getting someone of Roy's stature on the pod?
We've flirted with the idea in the past of asking Roy to do it, but assumed that he probably wouldn't. And he said yes with some alacrity, which is great. I think because he understands the role he talked about. I love the fact that he makes a distinction between a fan and a supporter, which I think is really interesting. But from my point of view, as somebody here who's the closest in age to, I mean, hearing him talk about football when he was a kid. Even simple things like sharing a house with Steve Kemba. That's all. But also, it's a cliche, but he understands Palace. But he understands football at our level. He understands the difference between being a Chelsea fan, a Liverpool fan, supporter, and being a Palace supporter. And he understands quite clearly the role of the pod. And I'll echo what Rob said at the start of the pod. You know, Palace has been an important part of my life since I was five, and the pod's been an important part of my life in the last 500 episodes. I've had some of the most joyful nights of my life recording this pod.
Most of them,
most of them. And I'm going to get emotional, but you and Streety were kids when I first met you, basically, and I found your attention slightly sinister, I have to say. But just by coincidence, you've been monitoring the club probably from its lowest point to currently its highest point. I mean,
yeah.
We wouldn't be here if it weren't for Steve and other people like him. And we were on air. I remember the panic, the distress, and then the relief, and then the subsequent joy from Wembley. Mm. And it's the pod's been that constant baseline ever since, and will continue to be so. And I think Roy makes a good point that these are the glory days. These are the golden times. And you know, be careful what you wish for when it comes to pushing for Europe. Because for my generation of fan, mid-table in the Premier League, it's not sexy to a lot of people, but for us, being through what we've been through, older fans, it's fantastic. And I love the fact that Roy understands that. I love the fact that, you know, some managers we've had in the past would have got a hump if we'd asked about Ray Lewington's shorts. He just tells us a story that ends up with a man in Sweden in hospital, which is great.
He was fantastic. Thanks as well for introducing me to new words. Alacrity, never heard of it. Going to use it all the time now.
I really enjoyed the human element of what Roy said. And he's a people person, and you can really tell that from his stories and the warmth that he has for people that he's worked with. He remembers names from his past, from the 70s, that helped to shape the career that he's had. And that, you know, Steve talks about his humility, and that really shines through. And when he talks about it was interesting him talking about managing in Sweden and essentially changing the game. The footprint that he had there made such a difference that the Swedish national team still play to the standard that he kind of set. So it was during the 2020 tournament, international tournament, that was Euros, wasn't it, I think, where Sweden played, I think, Portugal. It was one of the major sides, and they played a low block. And I remember messaging with Dom Fifield about it, and just saying, this is like watching Steve's Palace in terms of the way that we were playing. And Sweden won that game.
You mean Roy's Palace?
It's at Roy's Palace. And you get that kind of, you understand the nature of the person that he is, and the way he talks about fans, the way he talks about the players that he's worked with, and it's love really that he has for the game and also the people that he's worked with.
Beautifully said. I think that's a perfect place to go into the interview with Roy. So this is, after a quick short break, Roy Hodgson on the 500th episode of the FYP podcast. Celebrate our 500th episode, we're joined by one of the world's most recognisable managers. He's coached at 2 World Cups, 3 European Championships, he speaks 5 languages and has managed some of the world's best ever players, including Ronaldo, Rooney and Eberieze. It is, of course, Roy Hodgson. Roy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Stu. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. As ever, when we have big name interviews, we're also enjoying the superb hospitality. And yes, I will leave a 5-star review on TripAdvisor later. of Steve Browett. Steve, how are you?
Hi, yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Fantastic. And Kevin's here too. How are you?
Spent some time thinking about that one, didn't you?
Yeah.
Not even a welcome back.
How are you?
Well, how nice to celebrate the 500th edition with that traditional lack of welcome. JDR, I think that was the lack of welcome I got back on Chair 11. But also how nice it is for once not to be the elder statesman on a podcast. I'm really appreciating that role.
we'll stay as close as we can to the present day, I think. There'll be some younger listeners, I'm sure.
Oh, wait to my question about Jim Cannon, though.
We've got so many questions to ask you, and we really appreciate you being here. But first of all, it is the international break. What's that like as a club manager? Sort of empty training grounds? Is it a chance to take a break, or do you find it frustrating?
Well, I don't find it frustrating because I'm in favour, if you like, of international football. I think it's a great honour for your players when they're selected for their national teams. And having worked with so many national teams myself, it would be wrong of me to start complaining that someone else has taken the players away for a short period of time. It does give you a chance as well to spend a bit more time with players who maybe haven't been 100% in focus, which is good. But it's the numbers that are a problem. But that gives a chance, to be fair, to some of the players from the academy that we can bring over and give them a chance to train with other first-team players. So I think you can make quite a lot of it. And it also gives us that opportunity to, at least for the guys who are not playing international football, to give them a few extra days break, because we've got more than enough days to get the work that we need to get into them anyway. And it's, sometimes that's very good for foreign players, because if we give them 3 days instead of the usual sort of 2 day break, they can go home and see their families. So there are positives. And on this occasion, we haven't lost quite so many players as on the previous one, because unfortunately, Eze lost what I thought was going to be his spot to Cole Palmer, because he scored a good goal in the Chelsea game. Mm.
It's an indication of how much we've progressed, Roy, that in the past couple of seasons we've had so many players away during the international break. Because sort of 10, 12 years ago, that just wasn't the case, was it?
No, that's true. Although we've always had ones that go to the, you know, further flung countries. Really, we've always had the Africans, and that's sometimes a bit of a problem because their matches are played as well, not in sometimes quite distant parts of Africa. So you might be a Ghanaian like Jordan, or some from Senegal like Kouyaté, but your game might be in some quite remote part of Africa. And it's always been a bit of a problem getting them back because they sometimes have to travel quite a lot within their own country and then take a flight to Paris and then come from Paris. Mm. So instead of getting them back at the same time as you get your European ones, but now we've got more European ones, of course, largely thanks to the fact that I mentioned Eze, but also Sam and Mark Gay, them getting into the England setup has made a big difference, I think, for them and even for us as a club, because you know, once you've got players playing in the real top international nations, it makes people sit up and take notice.
You've got to go back a long way. I mean, I remember when Palace had Geoff Thomas, John Salako and Ian Wright all in the England team, and it was like, wow, you know, Crystal Palace has arrived, we've got three players in England. I don't imagine Palace have ever had more than three in an England squad.
When I first started watching, we had Paddy Mulligan playing for the Republic, and that was it, and a few
Scotsmen don't think even made the Scottish team.
It is an exciting time, isn't it, in terms of the players that Palace have and the calibre of them.
Well, I think that certainly 2 years ago when I left and thought I was leaving for good, actually, but when I left then, I think the club invested very wisely. They spent a lot of money at that time, but they've invested it wisely in rejuvenating the team, which we always thought we needed for a number of years. But they didn't just rejuvenate the team. They brought very good quality players into the bargain. So I think that's given us a better chance these days than of staying in the league, first of all, and trying to get as high up the league as we possibly can.
Kevin's got a question for you. We're going to go back a bit, if that's okay.
Sure.
Well, it's just because they do take the mickey out of me a little bit, Roy, for being of a different generation. But, you know, I don't think you're ever more obsessed with football than you are when you're 9 or 10, when you first get into it. And that's everything seems to be more colourful and vibrant then. But
true.
You went to a school that just produced legend after Palace legend, didn't you? I mean, Steve Kemba, Lenny Lawrence, you came. Yeah. Was there something in the water at that school? Or?
I think legend's kind, of course, but Steve Kemba really was the first one, I think, that really sort of made a real name for himself from the school in terms of playing, because both Lenny and I didn't have that playing background, and we got ours a bit later on through our coaching. There was another player, person there who became a very good coach, Bob Houghton, another one. So there was, it was a school, funnily enough, that did produce these people, but I think it was more coincidence than anything else. For example, Steve Kember, whom I grew up with when we lived in the same house for several years before his father became a policeman and went to live in Balham, I think it was. So they moved out. So I would have been about 9 or 10 when Steve moved out. We'd been together for a good 5 or 6 years. But then he came back, amazing enough, and his father came back to the Croydon area, moved to Shirley, and the school was in Shirley, and Steve moved to Shirley. So I only saw Steve there for the last couple of years of my schooling. But Len was there all the time. And Bobby Houghton was there, like Steve. He only came from a secondary modern school down the road, and in the sixth form came to the grammar school.
And did you think, when you were starting your playing career, did you think beyond that playing career? Did you think even then that the coaching was what you were heading towards? Or was that something that as your playing career developed, you decided you were interested in?
Yeah, my playing career failed to develop more to the point, but I mean, I suppose the passion for football was there, the desire to be a professional in the game and have only the game to think about. That was always there, but I had to come to terms fairly early on that, well, that's not going to work for me in terms of playing. And luckily, Bob Houghton was a very keen young coach at that time. We were very close friends. He pulled me along and we took this interest in coaching, partly because it was another string to our bow, but also it was another chance, you know, the coaching sessions and coaching, not just sessions, but the, you know, taking our badges. That was also playing football. We were going and taking our badges and being with other people and playing football. And then both of us decided we try to go into PE teaching, because in England at that time, probably still is, you know, you want to be involved in football, then PE teaching at school gives you a good chance, because that's what we did in those days. You know, there wasn't the choice. It was football in the winter and cricket in the summer. Mm. And if you like both of those sports, then PE teaching was not a bad place to be. But of course, for both of us, when the opportunity came to leave that side of it behind and go full time into the actual coaching work, we both decided very early on that we should give up our very mediocre playing careers to try and do something in coaching which might keep us actually in the game a bit longer as professionals.
I'm going to ask a question about Bob in a minute, but before I do that, I'm just going to go back a bit to watching Palace on the terraces with your father. Do you have any memories of that?
Yeah, I think you do. I think sometimes the further you go back in time, the more vivid your memories are. We live within walking distance, and there was a family 4 doors along from us. They were friends, if you like, and my father. So the 6 of us would walk along to the ground, which is about a 15-minute walk, and have the memories of that. I have the memories of sitting on the crossbar early on in Holmesdale Road, before the stand, of course, was built there. And also then, probably a little bit older, that was probably when I was about six. I think 6 was the first game. So around that time, it was the walking along and sitting on the crossbar. But as a few years went by, I changed that spot for being directly behind the goal, as close to the pitch as you can get, because occasionally the ball would come over and you got a chance to kick it back. And also in those days as well, funnily enough, you know, it's not the Crystal Palace of today. And, you know, the people listening to this, they can't really imagine the crowd or lack of it. So what I used to do, I would change ends at half-time, because you could just walk around, and that meant I was always behind the goal. Crystal Palace were attacking. Not that that meant I saw a lot of goals, but I was where any goals would be if they should come along.
This was third division south, wasn't it?
And fourth division.
And
yeah, I remember very well that year when the third south and third north decided to be combined.
Right.
And the top 12, I think it was, from each division, they would form Division 3, and the bottom 12 would be Division 4, and unfortunately we came in the bottom 12. So part of it was in the 4th Division.
Yeah. Some of the crowds, though, in those days were enormous. We had the top 3 4th Division crowds.
Really?
Because 33,000 against Millwall, for a fourth division game. So the big numbers would turn up in those days. I mentioned earlier, Roy, a friend of mine went to coach in Switzerland. And he says, whenever your name is mentioned, the imaginary cap with a feather is doffed. But you were a pioneer of learning your trade abroad, going to coach abroad. Not many English coaches did that. Is that something you would actively encourage players and coaches to do now? Because we've seen Jude Bellingham, Harry Kane, but there was a long time in the 70s and 80s when English coaches and players weren't really encouraged to ply their trade elsewhere, were they?
It swung around, Kevin, that one, because when Bobby and I went out there, we went out there on the recommendations of the Football Association, because that was where we'd had our grounding, that's where we'd been taught how to coach, and I've got enormous gratitude and respect for the education actually we were given. And at that time, we replaced, to some extent, an older guard of English coaches, you know, much more famous than Bobby Houghton and I, you know, Alan Ball and people of that nature who'd been out there. Alan Ball Sr., this is.
Yeah.
People of that nature who'd gone out probably pretty much near the end of their coaching careers, but with a CV of having worked in English clubs. But I think that, to some extent, they'd blotted their copybook on one or two occasions, and I think suddenly people were still quite keen on having an English coach, but they were thinking, well, can we think a bit younger? And then, of course, Bob Houghton went out there, and for 2 years he absolutely revolutionised the place. He won the league in his first season. He did the double in his second season. He changed the way the teams were playing because we went out there. I mean, I joined him. I went out in 79. He went there in 77. But all the other teams were playing man-to-man. You know, they were playing very Germanic football because Germany were the top international team and Bayern Munich were the top European team. So they were all copying them to the nth degree. And it was very simple to analyse your opponents because you knew this is how we're going to play and this is how they'll deal with it. You knew who was going to mark that one and you knew that behind that group of players would be what they called a libero or a sweeper. So that was, but of course we didn't play that way. We played pretty much an English system, which was pretty prevalent in England at that time. And it caused them problems. You know, having two centre forwards to mark caused them problems because they were used to marking one centre forward and two wingers, and that's what they did. So Bob swept the board there, and to be fair, it didn't have such a vast effect upon how people thought. They put it down to the fact that Malmö had the best players because they did have some very good players. You know, they probably, you know, had players who formed the backbone of the national team. But of course, when I came there and had success in the next 5 years by winning it twice, but without that sort of players, you know, with a more Crystal Palace-like aspect, if you like, no one could possibly look at Halmstad and say, well, they've got the best players, that's why they win. It was put down, really, to the fact that, well, the way that the team plays and the way it's organised is causing us problems. And I think that we are credited, both Bob and I, with revolutionising the football that you've seen Sweden play over the last, you know, goodness knows how long. And it would be false modesty to say that's not true. We did. And, of course, a lot of good coaches came in our wake, you know, Eriksson, Tord Grieb, Lars Lagerbäck, Roland Andersen, et cetera, et cetera. They were not disciples. Well, in fact, some of them were disciple-like. And they also took on the wrath, if you like, of the Swedish Football Association because they really just wanted it to put down to only English people can play this way and we don't particularly like it. We're going to continue going along in our Swedish way. But suddenly these people made it, no, hold on, this is the Swedish way. This is what our players like to do. This is what we're good at. We're going to move away. Well, I had a player, for example, there was a spell in 79 where we had two very good players, I thought, who were definitely candidates and should have been the national team, but the national team coach wouldn't pick them. All the time they played for Halmstad and played the way we played. Oh, wow. So it was quite a difficult time. But it's like everything else, you know, people they don't only forgive, you know, they have a good expression, the Swedes, that, you know, when when Satan grows old, he becomes religious, and that's a little bit what happened there with regard to Bob and I. But it was a wonderful start to a coaching career, I suppose, because both of us knew nothing but success for 7 years for Bob and 5 for me.
You and Bob, when you're out, it must be quite exciting. You must be thinking, we're doing something really exciting here.
Yeah, I don't know, really. I mean, I think both of us were pretty realistic at that time. We realised the life of a professional football coach is probably a short one, and that we need to take full advantage and, you know, enjoy it as much as we can, and certainly be aware that it might not be something that's going to last us through to old age, because we were both so young. You know, I was Bobby was only 27 when he started, and I was only 29, wow, or 28 stroke 29. So I think at the time we had a sort of an idea of, well, let's get to 40. If we can get 11 good years of this and really enjoy it, then maybe we can move on to something else. You know, we're not stupid, and we're not going to be totally without work if we can't get a job as a football coach. But, you know, luckily both of us have seen it right through to the end.
It would be like me in the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Next year, so.
But would you encourage, in terms of the English national team getting better, would you encourage English players to try and get experience abroad to make them better players technically?
I think anything that takes you out of a comfort zone, anything that puts you in a different environment, I'm not saying that you would necessarily move. If you're a top player in the Premiership, you wouldn't move abroad to get necessarily better football. But you might get a different experience which will enrich your life and broaden your perspective in life. But that's not going to happen, unfortunately, because the money in football decides everything, and the money's here. So, yes, Bellingham, sure, but and Kane, but you're talking about two different extremes. Bellingham, who was available, really, to be fair, at Birmingham, there wasn't one Premiership club that didn't know Bellingham was there.
Yeah.
But no one wanted to pay the money or take the chance. But Dortmund did, so congrats. And Kane, well, 30 years of age, end of a contract. Do I carry on or do I go for something a little bit different? There's a big swathe of players in the middle of that that don't even need to think about it. But I would definitely suggest that, you know, players a bit further down who are, you know, struggling really, I suppose, to make even a good living, if they got a chance. And I would definitely recommend it to some of the younger players, the academy players. I've tried on several occasions, both at Fulham and at Palace, to encourage players maybe to go to somewhere like Sweden or to Norway or to Denmark, or these type of countries to get, but it's hard to do so. They'd much rather go to Rochdale or Crewe Alexander or clubs in this country. Yeah. So I would recommend it largely on the basis of expanding your life and your experiences of becoming a more rounded person. And I think the more rounded person you are and the more experiences you've had, there's a chance it will make you a better footballer.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree. Can I ask you about Bob Houghton really quickly? Because I've got a question here about it, who are your coaching influences. But it sounds really like he really, really was.
He was, yeah.
I think in your career as well, there's often people that pop up that sort of lend you a hand and help you sort of get on your way somewhere. And it sounds like he did that in a big way for you.
Well, he did by, first of all, taking me with him to South Africa as a player. In England as a player, when Maidstone turned professional, we went to Maidstone together. So he took me in that respect. And then, of course, he went to Sweden while I was still in South Africa and then came back for a year here. And he was the one who recommended me for the job at Halmstad. We were very much contemporaries. You know, we would discuss football until the cows came home, really. And I certainly regarded myself as the lesser of the two, because he'd been at Ipswich with Bobby Robson as a youth team coach, whereas I wasn't in that area at all. And then when I went to Sweden, of course, we were very close during those 5 years, in fact, that I joined him back at Bristol City. So our contact was daily, and our discussions, which carried on, were very, very important to me. So I would say that Bob would be the most important influence. Mike Kelly was around at that time as well. He was a good influence as well, Mike Kelly. And then there's the people from the FA that were very good, not just Alan Wade and Charlie Hughes at the very top, but people like Ted Powell, who was a London regional coach, then Keith Blunt, perhaps even more so, Davy O'Grady, all London regional coaches. These were the guys, really, who put Bob and I on some sort of track. And once we got onto the track, we started doing okay. I mean, Bob went to a European Cup final. So it didn't do much better than that. In fact, I got a text from one of the players from that 79 team, who also played in my team in 85, saying they're on their way down to Munich now for a reunion.
Oh, wow.
Because it's, you know, nearly 25 years or whatever it is. So we were lucky then when we got onto that track to meet some other very important coaches, I think, who, just by having a chance to watch them and not just watch them, but actually talk to them afterwards, which sometimes you don't get if you, you know, if you just walk in as a young coach, can I watch you train? You might watch the training session, but to have the chance to actually talk to them and get to know them and, you know, befriend in a certain way. So that's when, you know, Bob Robson, Don Howe and Dave Sexton really came into my life. And then after that, Venables. These are the people I think that I've always admired their work and would like to think that I've been able to take something from those people. But if I was to say, well, but who were the ones who got you going? It wasn't these people, because by the time I got to know them or got to see them or got to have some form of contact with them, I was already 6 years into the job.
Obviously, Roy, we want to talk to you about Palace, but there's one general football question I'd like to ask you. When I first started going, you'd watch a centre-back like John Sewell or Jim Cannon or then Mickey Droy. You would never see them ping the sort of pass that you see Joachim making on a match-by-match basis. Apart from goalkeeper, what's the position you think has changed most since you became a coach? Because it seems to me that every single position is different now.
Yes, it is. I mean, where you start, I mean, goalkeepers, of course. I mean, but I mean, as you remember, it was a time when goalkeepers picked the ball up.
Yep, of course.
So the first thing that stopped that was the rule where goalkeepers weren't allowed to pick the ball up. That made a massive difference.
Yeah. Well, my dad said football ended the day goalkeepers started wearing gloves. That was it for him.
John Jackson didn't wear gloves, I think.
Yeah. Well, Peter Bonetti used to wear those gloves. But, I mean, you also had that time you had so many good goalkeepers as well, didn't you, in England? It's like John Jackson in any other generation would have played for England but couldn't get past Shilton and Clements, couldn't
he? Yeah, so I think goalkeeper is the obvious one, I suppose. Since that rule changed, goalkeepers started to improve anyway. But now, in the last 3 or 4 years, we are really seeing them used as playmakers. Mm. You know, they're being used as that extra man, because it's very difficult to press teams if the goalkeeper's good enough with the ball, because all that happens, he just drags your players further forward and opens up spaces behind you for people to play. So we're getting the stage now where goalkeepers are getting a bit more time, strangely enough, because people are working out, well, unless I've got a real good chance of getting there, I'm better off staying, because as soon as I get anywhere near him, he'll just slip past me or pass the ball past me, and we're going to be a man short. I think that another area that's changed is the one you've mentioned. But I remember Wenger at a meeting of the European Technical Study Group maybe 15 years ago, certainly 12 years ago, making that point, actually, in a meeting where that question came up, what's going to change most, do we think, in the next, you know, 10 years, let's say. And he said centre-backs will start coming out with the ball. We'll use them. Whereas in the past, they've just been stoppers, and only judged on their ability to stop goals being scored, or maybe go at the other end and be a threat from set plays. They're going to actually start taking part in the games.
I remember I saw some quote from Jack Charlton where he said he became a centre-back because he wasn't good at football, his brother.
Yeah, that's very modest of him, that. I know what you mean. And then full-backs have always overlapped. I mean, I remember overlapping full-backs in the 50s and 60s, really. I mean, certainly the 60s I worked with, a very, very good player in Sweden called Solander, who ended up playing centre-back and midfield for me, but he started his career as an overlapping full-back. He was such a good quality player. So that was quite, you know, that wasn't unknown, but now we're seeing a different type of full-back play. We're seeing a lot of underlapping so that people are making runs inside and not just outside of the winger, but also we're seeing them move into midfield. Quite a few teams now are trying to boost their midfield by putting a fullback who's got good quality or good composure on the ball, or is a good quality player on the ball, and running the risk that we'll just keep the other three and hope they can do the defending for us if we lose the ball. I don't know what other big changes can be made. I mean, I suppose you could talk about centre-forwards in the same way we've talked about centre-backs. You know, every team in the past tend to have a target playing centre-forward. You could have often two. You'd have your target player, and you've mentioned Andy Johnson, and he did that job very well for me at Fulham with Bobby Zamora, who was a target playing type centre. We're coming away from that a little bit as well. You know, you're seeing the Nketias of the world, you're seeing the Alvarezes of the world. You know, people really that in the past you would think, well, he's not centre-forward material. Well, they are, because they've got the quality to control balls played up to them. But, of course, what they can also do is they can make those runs behind, which are so important in the game. But I don't know where the next step will be. I think if anything, it will revert a little bit more towards what we're used to, because I think there's going to be a limit to the amount of possession football teams can play. I think the spectators themselves will get a bit fed up with just watching the team play the ball, centre-back, goalkeeper, centre-back, goalkeeper, full-back, goalkeeper. I think they'll get a bit fed up with it. And I don't know that we'll ever really encourage people to believe that we're a great team because we make 500 passes, if 420 of those passes are nowhere near the opposition's goal. Yeah. So I think you might see a little bit of a change in that respect and a bit more pragmatism, that if we're not going to be able to play out past this pressure that we're getting heaped upon us because the other team are so good at it and we keep losing the ball when we try to do it, you might see a bit more of a pragmatic approach of people, certainly from goal kicks at least, or from kicks near their goal, will start playing the ball forward a bit more. Once that happens, then of course there's going to be a bit more of a clamour for a centre-forward who can actually hold the ball up and win a challenge.
It's really strange. I've found recently that since they changed the rule that the ball doesn't have to leave the penalty area on goal kicks, it's almost like some teams think that's compulsory, that it has to stay within the penalty area. Yeah. And you see teams, certainly Norwich were victims of this, you see teams who can't play out from the back, trying to play out from the back. Well, Burnley, to an extent, I mean, they try and play out from the back and they're getting caught week after week by teams like us nicking the ball off them and
that's scoring. A very good point, Kevin. And furthermore, I think we do get sucked into it. I think pragmatism is a quality that people don't talk an awful lot about. You know, today you can only be regarded as a good team if you do what Man City and Arsenal are doing. But the problem is this might be quite a clever ploy from Man City and Arsenal's point of view, because they can do it and they've got the players to do it, but they might be sucking you into doing it and then taking advantage of the fact they're going to steal the ball from you very close to your goal. So, I think that's starting to... That would change slightly, I think, and we'll get back to a little bit more balance. It won't just purely be 50 passes before you cross the halfway line. There might be a few, and that would change the type of players we're looking for. But otherwise, I think where we've moved to in the last... How many years? I can't tell. I lose track of the years. But where the game certainly is today, it's in a very, very good place, I think, in terms of providing entertainment for the fans, because there's an awful lot of quality, technical quality, that wasn't evident in my memory many years ago. And the pace and the intensity of the game, that seems to accelerate every year. It's quite interesting that I don't know Vincent Kompany at all, really. I mean, I bumped into him on many an occasion when he was playing for Man City and said hello, but I don't know the man. But the interesting thing he said to me after the game a couple of weeks ago was that how much the Premier League has changed since he stopped playing. Wow. How much more intensive it is, how much faster it is, how much more technical it is. Now, what's that, 4 or 5 years?
Not long.
And that's quite a testament, that.
Yeah.
You know, I see that, I think. We talk about it amongst the coaching staff. It gets harder every year to match the intensity, to match the technical level, to match the physical level, to match the running. But it's good that someone like him can say it because he's actually been right in the middle of it and has won championships doing so.
Yeah. Right, I could listen to you talk about football all day. That was genuinely really, really fascinating. But should we come on to Palace?
Please.
But that, I really enjoyed that. That was really fascinating. So 2017, you get the call to come back to Palace. Did it feel like a sort of homecoming in a way, that this circle was complete from your youth, that now you're back as manager at Palace?
I've had that question quite a few times, of course, Jim, but I really don't know. I mean, I suppose to some extent I'd had so many jobs and travelled so much. I think that would only really have been the case had I never set foot outside of England during that time. I think it would have been a much bigger feeling. There wasn't a very warm feeling. It was very nice to have that suggestion that this is a homecoming and now you've turned a circle. So I don't want to dismiss that idea, but I'm probably would be exaggerating if I thought, yeah, you know, that suddenly everything slotted into place for me. I saw it as a very good job to have if they wanted me. I saw it as a big challenge because that particular year had started so poorly, and I didn't help because, you know, De Boer had lost the first four games, I lost the next three. So I mean,
they were quite tough ones.
They were tough games, Manchester ones.
But so we took on a tough challenge, but it was a challenge which I was really keen and happy to take on, and really pleased that, you know, Steve decided to go with me. And then, of course, when you're there, then that's, I suppose, when the memories start flooding back. Because on the way to Beckenham, where I pass my mother and father's house every day, and then on the way home, sometimes past the house where I was brought up, and all the places around that were so familiar, but that was quite a sort of nostalgic element. But I've got to say that for me, being a manager and having the responsibility of managing a football club in the Premier Division, nothing else really can get in the way of that, or you can't really look beyond that or take comfort in other aspects. It really is quite simply, how are we going to prepare the next game? What players have I got available? Are we going to win the game? If we don't win it, what's the next step? And all of those things. So really, whether you're at a club that you love to be at and have got some sort of feeling for because it's the club of your boyhood, or whether it's somewhere in Switzerland or in Italy or somewhere else, I think that that's what is the overriding factor at all times.
You obviously knew you were coming into a difficult situation, even though it was so early in the season, but was there a moment on the coaching field or on the playing pitch where you thought, actually, this is starting to click? Because for us, it was the Chelsea game.
Yeah.
When that performance, I wouldn't say it came out of nowhere, but that performance in both halves was of a level that we hadn't seen at Selhurst Park for quite some time against a very, very good Chelsea team.
Yeah. Well, I think both Ray and I had a lot of confidence in our coaching ability. What we didn't know is whether or not that was going to be taken on board by the players, or whether they, you know, not all players are keen on being coached. Not all players are that keen on having a very structured footballing environment. Some players are much happier if, you know, they're allowed to think that I know what I'm doing, I'm a good player, I don't need to be told and coached and drilled into playing a certain way. That's what we didn't know, how our approach, which had been pretty successful, you know, up to, I mean, not with England, I suppose, although having said that, the England was tournaments, it wasn't the rest of it, you know, only lost six games in 57, so we weren't losing every week, you know. But I mean, we knew, I think, Ray and I, that, well, if this group of players seemed a decent bunch, and you know, want to get on board with us, really, you know, we'll lead, we'll show you what we want, we'll work at it, and we'll hopefully put something before you that we think can work and will help us survive. Are you going to jump on board with it? And of course, that always evolves jettisoning one or two players along the way that you realise are never going to get on board. We didn't have to do much of that, really, but one or two of the older ones had to sort of move aside a bit. But that was okay because they... I mean, we had a player called Damien Delaney, who was an absolute toff, and Julian Speroni. They accepted that I'm a legend, this club, but maybe I'm not going to get so many games now. But they were actually quite important, people like him, and getting on board with the younger ones and bringing us all together. So I think we were... I've used the word pragmatic before, but I think we were realistic. I think we realised that it's going to be a fight, but we've got a dog in this fight. And if this dog can be trained well enough and it is willing enough to stay with us, we're not out of it by any stretch of the imagination. And in actual fact, the club had signed some quite good players at that time who hadn't succeeded that well. I mean, Loftus-Cheek and Kabay come to mind, yeah. Quality midfield players. If we can, suck out all of their quality, and of course, yeah, Wilf Zaha. I mean, no podcast you're ever going to be able to do or talk about, if we're talking about this latter period that I can relate to, can't be without Wilf Zaha, because he did take on enormous burden in getting us goals. That's the bottom line, because we didn't have a lot of those. And in fact, I can probably say that, during my time at the club, that's not something I've been blessed with, having a lot of goal scorers. But the players did well. They got on board, and of course we were successful. It was quite a good... We ended up 10th, didn't we? I think we were pretty high in the table.
Playing some really good football. Yeah. So was Wilf, before you even went to the club, was Wilf somebody you had identified as somebody would be a leader on the training ground for you?
I wouldn't say that Wilf was a leader on the training ground. I mean, I think Wilf was a leader when he got onto the field to play, right, because he's a footballer. He wants to play. The thing about Wilf is he didn't get injured very often. He didn't miss training sessions. Right. He could be a nuisance in the training sessions because he was moaning at the others or unhappy that people didn't reach his quality all the time. But we had other leaders. We were very lucky there to have other leaders. In particular, MacArthur, Milivojevic. They were good leaders in the team. Ward, of course, has always been there. So we had those sort of players who I think were really good players, but also very good, solid citizens who accepted the responsibility, accepted that we've got to get behind these two if we're going to go anywhere. So let's go all in. And it wasn't difficult to drag Wilf along. If you'd have said to Wilf, "Are you enjoying these training sessions?" he'd have said no. Because, he really wanted to do the type of training session that he liked to do. But luckily, the others tempered any real criticisms he might have had, and as a result he got on with it and did well. But he was a very important factor.
It's amazing how fit he stayed considering the punishment
he got on the pitch. Yeah, Paddy McCarthy said to me the other day, which I thought was quite relevant. I mean, I suppose I have thought of it before, but he brought it home to me very, very clearly. He said the bravest people on a football field are the forwards, he said, because we kick them, but they don't kick us.
Yeah. Where does Wilf rank in terms of the players you've coached down the years? Because to a lot of Palace fans, he's probably Palace's best ever player that they've seen play.
Yeah, I would think that's probably true, isn't it, for what he did, I mean, for so long. I think if you're going to talk about someone being the club's best ever player, a bit like we've now seen with Sir Bobby Charlton, you've got to have some sort of a background. Yeah. You've got to have some sort of longevity. Yeah. You can't say, well... He was great. He was a wonderful player. He was only with us a year and a half, but what a wonderful player. I think anyone who comes into that category, Crystal Palace best ever player, you've got to talk Kemba, you've got to talk Cannon, you've got to talk
Ian Wright, maybe Pete Taylor,
people like that. Yeah. They're the people who come into it. And I think where Wilf will score largely over many, he did it in the Premier League. Don't forget Crystal Palace haven't always been in the Premier League. We can sometimes forget that. This is 12 years and we're in danger, I fear, of taking a little bit for granted. But, I mean, that's not the Crystal Palace I grew up supporting.
No, none of us, I think.
What is it like supporting a club? I know you said before about that everything around preparing for the games comes first, but when it is a club that you support... and that you have a connection to. What is that like? Maybe does it add something to a match day? Or
Do you know, I think that's really more a question for you guys, really. I mean, I think that my admiration is really for people who have followed a club through thick and thin and, you know, really based their lives to some extent around that. I mean, I'm sitting next to Steve Broward, who alongside with Steve Parish actually maybe saved this club, you know, saved this club even from going under, let alone not playing Premiership football. And I think it's you people really who are the lifeblood. I think we that work in it and we that, you know, see it as our daily bread, our job, our passion, I think sometimes it's harder for us to get that feeling that a true fan has or a true supporter. I actually prefer the word supporter to fans. I really do. I've said this on many occasions. I think what we need from people really is a bit of support. We all want to win. There's no one more gutted after a defeat than players. And, you know, if fans ever think, what does it mean to a football team to lose a game, then I'd invite them into our dressing room sometimes after a defeat, especially a harsh one like we had to suffer on Saturday. And, you know, that they will see people, pardon me, crushed almost by it. And furthermore, not just for a few hours, crushed for days. Paddy McCarthy said to me today, you know, seeing you and Ray at the moment, is this what I've got to look forward to? I mean, I'm expecting it to get better. You know, it did not get better with the years. It doesn't. I know. That's the problem.
My wife said to me recently, she knows I'm getting mellow because I'll stop sulking by Tuesday.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's
because Sundays are ruined for me. No, well, I don't buy the papers. I don't watch Match of the Day.
That's exactly it, Kevin. That's exactly where it is. And I think that the supporters, that's the way they're going to feel too. But like us, to some extent, you have to learn to live with it because you have to develop the character somehow to survive it, because otherwise you'll just go through your life moaning, complaining, wishing. You know, there's got to be a certain level of realism as well. That's the important factor. And I think sometimes the way fans are encouraged to react today, they're being drawn away from the reality of their situation. Mm. You know, the big question for me, for Crystal Palace fans, was, how important for you is it to watch Premier League football? How important is that? Or do you just want to see a team win? Because if you just want to see the team win, then don't be upset when we get relegated, because we win a lot of games when we get relegated. You know? Yeah. But if you want to see Premiership football, I'm afraid you've got to accept that with our resources, where we are, you know, we don't spend £1 billion on football players. You know, we have to compete with these people. And I think we compete with them pretty well on you know, for the best part. And we need your support there for that, because this club means something to you, as it should do, because it's not just a bone of fire day top-class football club. It's a club with a really good history, a history of hardship, a history of, you know, ups and downs, a history of, you know, it's not always, you know, everyone's a you know, these days, everyone's a Man United, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea supporter. That wasn't in the 1950s. I don't remember many Chelsea supporters. I don't remember many Liverpool supporters, because they weren't winning every week. You know, so that's what I would say. And I think that for supporters, that feeling that they get as a group together is something that we, to some extent, in the middle of it, are going to miss. We don't get it in quite the same way. We get what's going on, of course we do. We get that with bells on, but we don't get necessarily the feeling, because the feeling for us is a bit, the dagger going into the heart is a little bit harder when you're coaching and playing than if you're going home afterwards just moaning, why the hell didn't we do this and how the hell can he play X?
Well, I think it's a generational thing for some Palace fans as well, because you've got a lot of younger Palace fans who have grown up only knowing the Premier League.
Sure.
You get fans like the same situation that happened to Charlton. You get people going, well, why aren't we spending money we haven't got to get into the Europa League? And then you do that and you risk ending up where Charlton end up.
Or Portsmouth, or many others. Who are another example of a team that spent money they didn't have.
Can I ask you, Roy, because before we shouldn't really get into politics and economics of football, though there is a book out I can recommend.
Yes,
beautifully done.
What was it like? What was the match day experience like during lockdown? How different and uncomfortable was it? And was it only during lockdown that you realised quite how chatty Ray Lewington could be?
No, Ray's got a deep voice. He's to be fair, but even the level of his voice doesn't help a great deal when people are playing because you don't. You can only get so far with that voice. But it was, I think, surreal, I suppose, is partly the word, but I didn't like the experience. It didn't. You missed the match day experience. You missed fans. You missed you missed the atmosphere. You missed the oohs and the ahs. You missed the excitement and the tension that comes in it. And it became a little bit more like playing a match amongst yourselves on the training field. So I didn't enjoy it at all, I must say. It was it was a survival thing for us.
Well, so I actually went to the games because they allowed the owners and directors in.
Of course, what was that like?
It was awful. It was so weird. As Roy says, it didn't feel like a proper game. Even though this is a Premier League game and it counts and there's 3 points at stake. It just, football without fans is just nothing.
Were they still doing catering and stuff then in the boardroom?
A sandwich in a paper bag. it was awful. No, there was no wine involved.
I can't remember which, I think it was Leicester over Christmas. Well, I was missing it so much. I got as close to Homestead as I could without breaking any cordons just to hear the noise of a ball being kicked. It's strange. But tell us about your relationship with Ray, because everyone, I mean, you've been together a long time.
Since 2008.
He seems an immensely popular figure around the club. So how does your relationship, do you sit down on a Monday and go, right, this is how it's going to work, or has it just become sort of natural and organic between you?
Oh, no, we still talk. I mean, now, of course, Paddy's involved. I've been very lucky, really, not just with Ray, but first with Stephen Reid, then with Dave Reddington, and now with Paddy McCarthy. Excellent younger coaches, which are a great help to us as well. I mean, and I've got to say that both Ray and I, over the years, we've handed over more responsibility certainly to Dave when he was there, and now Paddy, which they seem very happy to take on. And to some extent, we're taking something of a step back, although we are still both, very much involved in the daily coaching. But Ray, I, funny enough, I passed him on his prelim badge many years ago when he was playing at Chelsea. I passed him, I was sent in as the examiner, the person who'd taken the course at Chelsea. Dave Sexton, with his incredible foresight, got the younger players to take a prelim badge at the time, which was a course of about 12 sessions, I think. And they had a coach assigned to them who did those sessions, and then I got sent in on the examination day, and our job basically was to rubber stamp, if you like, the coach's assessment. So when the coach has said, this guy's done the course, I think he's good enough, I think he should get the badge, we went in. It was an FA thing. They were supposed to make certain that people weren't being given badges just because they were mates of the guy taking the course. So, funny enough, I remember both Ray and Ray Wilkins on that course. So, I had, and I also took him with the London Schools. He was in a London Schools team that I coached at Barn Elms when he was about 14, 15, 16. Yeah. Wow. So, I knew of him, I knew his name. I'd come across him again, of course, when I went to Blackburn Rovers, and he was, back at the Palace. And then, when I went to Fulham in 2008, he was there. He'd actually just been moved back up again by Sanchez before I came. Before that, he'd been basically with the academy for a while. And, of course, I made certain that he stayed with me and Mike Kelly, and that's when we started to work together, the three of us, and that's continued, really, in all the jobs we've had.
I used to love watching Ray Wilkins play. It just always seems to have a yard of space around him.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's a class player. But Ray Lewington was a very good player too.
He was.
So he's very popular within the club because of his personality and because of his coaching ability and his tactical knowledge. So I think that for me, I find having him working with me is of vital importance. And the same with Paddy, really. because it would take a lot out of me if I didn't have them taking over such a lot of the work that they take over, not least of all with the video, scouting people, putting together the videos that we show in our post-match and pre-match preparation. That is hours and hours of work they put in before we can put it before the players, and I'm very grateful for the work they do there.
And what is the deal with Ray Lewington wearing shorts all the time?
No, I don't know. I think that might go back to the old days. I'm trying to think of his name. Brian Birch was his name. There was a guy called Brian Birch. He came to, you talk about people coming to Sweden or going abroad to further their careers, and Brian Birch was a Busby babe. It sounds like I'm talking badly of him. I don't mean to. He died many years ago. And he was quite a nice fellow, actually. But when I was at Halmstad in, I think it would have been about 76, 77, he came over from whichever club he'd been at in England. And he was a Busby babe. He had quite a reputation. And he took over this team in the league below the top league, not far, funny enough, from where I was working. And I went down to meet him one day there. But the story that they told me about him was really quite... I remember the first he complained about was people being too obedient at traffic lights. he said they don't go, even though there's not a car to be seen, they still wait there. But the other thing that I remember was it got cold in. This was pre-season. I went down in a pre-season, so it had been a late January, early February.
Oh, that's cold.
Training on sand pitches. And the story goes that he actually went out there and his first day, dressed in shorts, of course, and just a sweatshirt, and he got all the players lined up, and they had hats and gloves and scarves and tracksuit tops and kind of that. And he said, right, who are the goalkeepers? And a couple of guys put out, and he said, right, you can come forward now, take your hat off, take your scarf off, take those tracksuit bottoms off, you can keep your gloves on. Now the rest of you, I don't want to see any gloves, no scarves, no hats, whatever. So Swedes being Swedes, they actually did that.
Yeah.
But then 2 days later, he was in hospital with pneumonia.
Oh, my word.
So that's the...
Not the twist I was expecting.
But it's great. I mean, from our point of view, it's great to have somebody like yourself who is a Palace fan, but also somebody like Paddy, who is a really good player for us as well, because football fans love, or supporters, as we would say, from that. They love continuity.
I think the club's... Kieran, I think the club tries hard to do that.
Yeah.
You know, what the club has done with Steve over these last few years in getting that academy up and running. I mean, that in itself is an achievement. What we're doing now with the stadium.
Yeah.
You know, this club is moving forward all the time. You know, I think that supporters at the end of the day should be pleased that an extra few million pounds is being spent on the academy, in producing players, on coaches and on the stadium, rather than necessarily making a player that we only see for a few months that little bit richer. You know, it's a question of where you spend your money. And there's got to be an element of realism. You know, from the moment Ray and I came in 2017, we realised that our job is to work with the players that are there, that the players can afford, and that we think want to be there. Try and get rid of the ones who don't want to be there, of course, but the ones who want to be there and the ones that the club say, this is what we can give you to work with, that's what, you know, we enjoy doing and are more than happy to do. Because once you start talking, there was a time, it seems to me, where you didn't talk so much about changing players all the time. Every time something didn't go quite right, let's get another one. In those 5 years in Halmstad, where we won the championship twice, on at least two of those occasions, the 76 team that won, the 79 team that won, we did it with 16 players.
Yeah.
And in the 79 team, there was still, I think, 8 of the 11 who played the 76 team. Yeah. Whereas now we all seem to be, well, get something better, get something better, yeah, get something better. We'd all love to do that. But I think our supporters should look around and say, well, is it working all the time? Has it worked at Manchester United? Has it worked at Chelsea?
No. The money that they've spent, particularly Chelsea.
It's no guarantee.
If you want an example of how not to do it, and the opposite way that Palace have done it, then that's it.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, they've basically paid Brighton I don't know, what is it, over 200 million they've paid to Brighton for a manager and two or three players.
Yeah.
And it hasn't really, I mean, maybe they are just starting to click, but it hasn't really been good value for money, has it?
In Jose Mourinho's career, a brilliant manager, but he's earned 110 million quid from payoffs, from being sacked. Because even managers of his quality don't get the time they should be given to rebuild a team.
Yeah. And the interesting thing with Chelsea, I think, from a Palace perspective, is that, you know, Doug and I were keen to sign Gallagher the year before you actually got him. He came when I left, but we were keen to sign him actually in the summer before I left. And now he's probably one of Chelsea's most important players.
Yeah. He plays every game, doesn't he?
He plays every game. Despite he's captain them buying the team. Other people. Yeah. So the fact is, I think sometimes if you've got a good guy like he obviously is and a good player like he is, you know, you might do well to try to suck out everything that he can give you before you then start going and buy someone else's star. And putting a star team together doesn't always work, unfortunately. It needs to be done in pieces. I think at the moment with Palace that there is a nucleus of really good quality Premiership players at the club. So the trick, I think, is going to be now, and I'm speaking personally, but I'm pretty certain if you have Steve Parish on here, he'll be saying very much the same thing as I'm saying. The trick is to sort of build upon that now by bringing in one or two more pieces which can make us a bit better. But maybe the most important thing of all is what the club succeeded in doing this year, keeping two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About Eze, because he's getting him tying down to contract is huge news, and he's such a wonderful player to watch for the fans. He glides across the pitch, but obviously when you came back last season, he was struggling for form. Is there something that you do with players like that to try and reignite their form?
Well, I think sometimes if players are going through a bad spell, and we had it with Sterling when he came in 2016, he'd not been playing at Man City, he'd been being left out, and he was really quite low, and you know, all we did in the build up to it was to try and encourage him that, listen, you know, we like what you do, and we're going to encourage you to do what you do. We're not going to put restrictions upon you, so it's up to you really now. And it's a little bit like that with Ebbs as well, in a way that, you know, he was in and out of the team, he was losing a bit of confidence, and we made it clear to him, well, look, we like what you do, you know, we think we can really use you. Now it's up to you. We're going to give you the chance to play, work in training, and make certain you understand fully what we do want from you. But all the time you're giving us what we want from you, we're right behind you. And we knew, of course, that if we could get that, it wouldn't take long for the fans to get behind him, because, you know, he's got qualities. You know, he's got exceptional quality. He is a high-quality Premiership player who could play in many, many teams in the Premiership.
Because I often think fans and people in football forget that players are people sometimes. It's as much as managing the emotional side of it rather than stuff on the training ground.
Well, I think it's a very important point, Jim. The game is not played on a magnetic board. And it is, unfortunately, when you're coaching, much as though we can get very irritated when people aren't doing exactly what we think they perhaps should be doing, and which certainly they wouldn't do if we were showing them on the magnetic board or on the training field, this is what you've got to do. They are human beings, and human beings make mistakes. And one of our mantras has been that we don't mind mistakes. We don't mind honest mistakes. We don't, you know, if we're telling you that in this situation we want you to run at a defender with the ball, if you run at him at the wrong time and lose it, we're not going to criticise you for that. Now, we might criticise you if in those situations you keep passing the ball backwards, because that's not what we want to do. So we're behind you in doing what we all agree, i.e. you and us, that we agree is the right thing to do. And in doing that, you're going to make mistakes. Mm. We'll forgive them, And what you've got to learn to do is when you made a mistake, work hard to recover it, because recoveries are one of the most important aspects. And, you know, that's something that I like our fans to think about sometimes, you know, that when they see a player losing a ball or running with the ball and not doing what we would like to see, ask yourself the next question, well, what's he like after it? What's his next move been? Because that's what we're always looking at.
Mm.
What's the next move? We don't mind you losing it, but we will if you stand there and look behind you and expect someone else to help out and get you the ball back. Mm. That's got to be love at your responsibility. And recovery runs are so important. And if we take that game against Burnley recently, there were some really incredible recovery runs from players, you know, 40, 50-metre sprints to get back behind the ball after we'd lost it up at the other end. And they're the things which, unfortunately, don't get pointed out necessarily to supporters.
Mm.
You know, at the weekend, it's all about... They don't, for me, often mention the salient points. The Man City goal, where the turn of on the halfway line from, pardon me, Haaland. No one points out what's the midfield player doing there.
Mm.
What on earth has prompted the midfield player to think he can win that ball in front? But well done, Haaland. But then the pass to Alvarez. And Alvarez's unbelievable quality of pass to play in whoever it was, Foden, was it, on that side?
Yeah.
But not just that. What about the overlap run?
Mm.
So he's had to run forward. He's had to make a long run forward when Haaland's turned. So he'd made a good 20-metre sprint forward, got the ball. At the sign of the first pressure, he's played it really through the eye of a needle, if you like, to Foden, who's controlled it. And then as Foden's controlled it and looked to move inside, he's actually made another 25-metre sprint to get behind him. And then, on top of that, when he gets there, he produces a really good quality cross. Mm. Now, they're the type of things I would like to point out to. Not just, you know, the tapping at the back post. It's all of those things, really.
We deliberately didn't want to talk about individual players because we'd be here all day, but Jordan Ayew, he's got to be the best £2 million the club's ever spent, isn't he?
You know, he's such a good character, that's the thing. He just loves football. He just loves playing. He's a very tough character.
Yeah.
Well, he's tough mentally and he's tough physically. I think he's getting better and has got a lot better over the last 5 or 6 years in terms of realising what he's best at and what he's not quite so good at. But character plays a big part. And the one thing I would say, certainly, if I think back to these 5 years or so I've had at Palace now, there's been a lot of very good characters here, a lot of extremely good characters. I think, sorry, one, Delaney, what a good character he was.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah?
James McArthur.
Yeah. You know, there's been so many, you know, and even guys, forgotten guys, Martin Kelly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the number of times I put him in at right back, coming into the team, and no one regarded him. Ward. I mean, these people really should get more credit, I think, because character plays a part. There's no doubt. It's the old adage you get. Well, it's not an adage, really. It's any leader's books you care to read from any sports in particular, maybe the American ones. They are all 100% in agreement that talent may get you so far in the game, but it's character that's going to keep you there.
Yeah.
And that's something we sometimes don't take into enough consideration.
I'm afraid it's been a running joke on the pod for the last 10 years, my annual Christmas apology to Joel Ward. I start every season by saying, probably time for Joel to move on now. And then at Christmas I go, he's still a really good Premier League player, isn't he?
Incredible.
It's happened every season. So I think he's one of those players that none of us expected.
No.
We all hoped that he would get a few games in the Premier League for his sake, but he's just been
done amazing.
There's a few of them, isn't there? You know, we're blessed in that respect.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that if we're not careful, all of us, and I take myself and my coaching staff into this equation as well, if we're not careful, our desire to keep getting better, to keep doing more, heaping pressure to some extent on the players to give us more, give us sometimes more than maybe they're capable of giving, we're in danger of ruining a lot of what this club has become, I think, rather than, not if I can say it, always been, you guys would know better than me, but certainly what this club has become. It's a place for people who are serious about the game, who are prepared to really roll their sleeves up and put in a shift in the game. And if then, of course, we can get those players with the quality of the Ezzies and the Gays and the Andersons and the Elisa's, then if we can get that alongside that quality, then, of course, there's no limit. But I just urge the fans still to, disenchant themselves from the idea that suddenly, from one year to the next, Crystal Palace are going to spend £200 million on players, which I can't see happening in the near future. And more importantly, be careful where that £200 million goes. And I had money to spend at Blackburn Rovers. Jack Walker, we had a very good first season. We got into Europe. They'd almost got relegated the year before I came, and went there, we got into Europe. Everything was fantastic. I was being touted for the England job. Yeah. Everything was magnificent. And Jack was desperate to sign players because he had so much money in the bank. But you know what the problem was? Any of the good players I recognised didn't want to come.
Oh, because they were an unfashionable club.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we were offering them European football. So that's another aspect, there's no guarantee that if Steve Parish says to me or the next manager, there's £200 million to spend, go and buy four £50 million players. It's not certain we're going to get those four £50 million. Yeah. And the next thing is one of those £50 million players going to be like one of those 50, 70, 80, million, £100 million players that we're currently seeing at Man United and Chelsea? And you might be thinking about, what a pity we let Jordan Ayew go.
Fans are every, because fans say, well, we need a 25 goal a season striker, but every club in the Premier League so if one comes available, way down the pecking order to sign them.
Well, I think that I think, to be fair, we should have been way down the pecking order to sign one of the two we've already got, if the truth is.
Yeah.
So I don't discount that that's a possibility. The major problem there is finding that person.
Yeah.
And every, there's not a team really outside of the top three or four in the country, and I'll count Chelsea and Man United almost in this category, who aren't saying, if only we had that striker, if only Van Nistelrooy was still with us, if Ian Wright was still here. We're always going to be saying that, and that's why the job of Doug Friedman becomes more important every year, because we can't do what some of these other clubs can do. We can look around and say, well, look, Brighton are below us, Palace are below us, Fulham are below us. Who are their best players? Well, they want a lot of money for them, but we'll take them. Yeah? When are we able to do that? I don't think, unless someone puts that enormous treasure chest forward. Yeah. So we've got to find a Gay, a Chelsea loanee playing at Swansea and doing well. We've got to find a Gallagher at Charlton and then Swansea playing well. We've got to take a chance on Anderson, who's been relegated with Fulham, but we still like the look of him.
Yeah.
We got that. That's what I think we've got to do, and I think Doug's done an outstandingly good job in that respect, and that's how it's going to have to be if we're going to move forward, as I believe this club is going to move forward.
Roy, it's been such a pleasure having you on and listening to you talk about the game. If you ever thought about starting a football podcast, I would definitely listen and subscribe. It's been a pleasure. I'm just going to round off with one more question, if possible, because we got asked by the Seaman Says podcast, which is David Seaman's podcast, for a question for Sam Johnson. He was a guest recently. And so we said, what's it like playing for Roy Hodgson? And he really eulogised, very long question about playing for you, but I picked out this bit in particular, and I'll drop in the audio for our listeners.
I played at the back end of last season after not playing so much, and then I got back into the England squad in the summer, and he was like he was just so proud of, he's been the England manager, and he was, it was literally like he was a family member of how proud he was of not just me, but all three of us, Mark Wyatt and Eze got in the squad, and he was like, asking when we come back, how was it? How long was you at St. George's? Where did you move on to? What did you do? Really, really interested in what we'd done. And as soon as you come back, he's got a smile on his face. And the first thing he asks you is, how was it? Was it St. George's?
That's great to know that he's still got that passion for England, that.
Yeah. He does. He literally does. He was so happy and proud to, for you to want to go, and then secondly, to know what you got up to when you was there, how was it, and this, that, and the other, asking, you know, different things and stuff. So, yeah, he's literally just a great person.
Do you feel that pride then when young players get called up?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm a big fan of international football, of course, because international football has been good to me, starting with Switzerland and then with Finland and England. The UAE, slightly different. That was like a hiatus to some extent in a long career. But the other three, they've all been wonderful experiences where I've, you know, worked with good people, worked with very good players and, you know, learnt a lot, of course. So when a player gets picked for his national team, I think that's always a red letter day. And if it's England, you know, being English and having worked with England, perhaps slightly more so. And I'm always pleased to see people get there from clubs like ours because, you know, we have to accept we're not the first spot on Match of the Day that often. You know, we aren't Sky Sports' first choice always to be on TV because that's reserved for United, Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal, etc., etc. We have to accept that. It's the same in every country. If you're working in Spain, you've got to accept that most things are going to veer towards Barcelona, Valencia and Real Madrid. If you're in Germany, Bayern Munich will be on the television virtually every week and you might get a little look in every now and again as Bayer Leverkusen. You've got to accept those things. But having said all of those things, I think it's quite amazing that we as a football club, and we're not alone, I put other clubs in the category, can compete as well as we do in what has become a very uneven playing field because so many teams above us are able to go out and scour Europe and scour the continent, scour Africa for the best players. So, you know, there's no prizes for working out that Shobolosai is a good player. You know, that's, you know, you'd have to be living in another planet if you were looking for a midfield player and you hadn't thought about Shobolosai. You'd be living in another planet. But the fact is, only certain clubs could get that player. So we have to accept to work hard with the ones we got to try and reach, to get them to reach the best level they can reach and compete, you know, at an equal level with these players. And I think that's what Palace have done for a number of years. I think it's what Palace will continue to do. And I'm very, what's the right word here? I find it very praiseworthy that you have this podcast, which has been going for 500 editions and for so many years, what, 2008, you said, that's almost 16 years, and you're prepared to get round a table once or twice a week and provide for the fans some sort of insight into your Crystal Palace. Because a football club is a fans' club. It is. But fans can enrich that club and send it forward and keep it going, keep the lifeblood going. But fans, unfortunately, also can suck the blood out of clubs. And you've mentioned two or three already early on in the podcast where that's definitely happened, where the heart and the desire and the burning ambition has not been linked to what the club is capable of achieving. Now, I don't think that's the case with us at all, but certainly the work you do is very useful, I think, in that respect, in, you know, putting a sane point of view forward at a time when sometimes sanity is hard to find because football is emotional. I think you said that, Kevin, early on. And when you're emotional, you don't think with your head. You don't have vision. You don't have perspective. You just want to change. For example, after the game on Saturday, I wanted to hurt someone. I hurt myself. But you end up hurting yourself.
Yeah, of course.
Roy, thank you so much. And well, I'm definitely going to use the quote, a sane podcast. put that on our posters.
Please do.
It's been such a joy having you on. Thank you for joining us for our 500th podcast. We really appreciate it. And all the best for the rest of the season.
No, thank you very much, Jim.
Hodgson, on the 500th episode of the FYP podcast, sponsored by our friends at Eternity Home Finance. Email info@eternityhomefinance.com. And for a free consultation, quote the code FYP. So a huge thank you to Rory for his time. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone at the club that helped sort that out as well. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to you guys for being here. Kevin, that was... I mean, that was incredible, wasn't it?
Well, it was a pleasure. I mean, it was a privilege as well. But I also think we need to be thanking all the people that have listened to this pod right from the very start. You've grown it from a tiny little acorn into a must listen for most Palace fans. And also, you have to thank those Palace fans who have sent in some of the funniest questions. That's some of the reasons I've had so much laughter.
Well, they kept us going, didn't they?
They kept us going for a long time. Yeah. But it's I'd say it's been a pleasure and a privilege to do. And there are too many people to name. By name.
Yeah.
Damn. Well, I was trying to be more erudite there, but we'd be here all night again if we mentioned everybody that's been involved with the pod. But yeah, it's the people listening to it week in, week out that are the most.
And do you know what's nice, Rob, as well, and I know you get this at games as well, is often I get people come up to me at Palace games and just being incredibly kind and nice about the podcast. And I think you forget sometimes when you're putting it out each week and if Palace have lost or whatever and you're sort of trying to get an hour's chat out of it, the people are really thankful for it. And it's very nice. Every time people say nice things about the pod in person, it's always appreciated.
Well, that's because they don't know how arrogant you are.
Well, they will now.
That's because they weren't there at the time when you first heard somebody walked past and somebody said, that sounds like that bloke from the pod.
Yeah.
And you couldn't stop talking
about
it.
And the best thing about that was Andy Street was next to me and he had no idea who he was, yeah. Which was great.
I think it's just a mark of the work that you guys have done. And I say you guys, I do the post-match podcast and I get lots of people come up to me and say thank you for that. But I think the regular, it is hard work. Honestly, there are times after watching Crystal Palace lose where, you know, either logging on to a Zoom call or, you know, going to someone's house in the wet and the rain, which Kevin loves, obviously. He's the one sitting there waiting for you to arrive in the warm. It is hard. It is like, oh, do we have to talk about that? But after talking about the Palace match, I tend to find that draws the line under it, you know. And very often I listen to, when Palace win, I want to enjoy that high a bit more, and the podcast really helps me with it. And when we lose, it's great to listen to. To just understand that actually what I witnessed wasn't wrong, or that maybe I was wrong and that I needed to review what I thought. But I can't say it enough. I mean, JD and Andy and you know, you, Kevin, as well, you've been such cornerstones of this existence when it comes to the FYP podcast. You really do deserve a lot.
Adding that, that's very kind of adding that to the poster alongside Rory Corner, voice in a sea of whatever it was, which was lovely. I think we should wrap up there. Thank you to everyone who's supported us along the way. Thank you to Steve, you know, for constantly helping us do these fantastic interviews and being a real support along the years, Steve. So thank you. And of course, for saving the club, you know, probably.
Yeah.
Big thanks for that as well.
Oh, yeah, that.
Someone had to do it.
I knew there was something.
Yeah. Really appreciate it. Thanks to everybody that's listened, our patrons, all our people behind the scenes, hosts, many people to thank.
And also Palace for existing being the lifeblood of our entertainment, even when it goes wrong sometimes.
Quite. It's just,
we wouldn't be able to talk about anything else. That's what we are. That's what we're doing.
Beautifully put, Rob. So thank you very much to Roy for joining us. Thanks to everyone for listening. Here's the next 500. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.